Welcome to Ask Peggy About Your Finances, because prosperity is so much more than money. Brought to you by writer, speaker, and certified financial planner, Peggy Doviak.
Hello, and welcome to the Ask Peggy About Your Finances show. My name is Peggy Doviak, and I'm a certified financial planner practitioner and a personal finance author. This is a show to help you understand your money better, and I've got some great topics today. We're going to talk about stubborn inflation, finally, the fiduciary rule, how to turn your financial dreams into financial goals, and then finally, in the Ask Peggy segment, I'm going to talk about different kinds of small business retirement plans. Before we get going, Oklahoma was in the news a lot this weekend because of the terrible storms, and I just want to give a shout out to the towns in Oklahoma that have so much devastation and all of the people trying to come together to help. There really is something called the Oklahoma Standard, and it was on display this weekend as folks were trying to help people who lost absolutely everything in the tornadoes, put everything together again. So here's hoping we have a slightly calmer spring from here on out, because Saturday wasn't any fun at all. But the market had a good week last week. This is data for the week ending April 26th, 2024, and the Dow went up about 0.2%. Well, the S&P 500 went up about 2.2%. The NASDAQ went up 4%, while gold dropped 2.3%. Oil, West Texas Intermediate Crude, front month price was up about 0.5%, and it's currently $83.68 a barrel. The 10-year Treasury yield went up 4.3%, and it is sitting at 4.669%. The dollar is down 0.06%, so 0.0006%, and Bitcoin was down about 1%. So last week's data was both good and bad for the market. We've had kind of a down period here for a while that seems to be turning back around again. The decline began about the 1st of April, and people are saying April's numbers aren't going to be good, and they're not. But it's also not that uncommon to have a pullback when you've had a lot of up in the market, which we had in the first quarter. I like to see the rebound that we had the last half of the week, because it suggests that some of this is just normal market action and isn't anything really to panic about. There are some things on the horizon that are looking a little more troubling than we might have thought, and that all concerns inflation and weirdly strong economic data. So, what is the state of the United States economy? From a macroeconomic level, it's really great. The numbers are coming in really, really good. So why is that a problem for the Federal Reserve? Well, when they have great data and the next movement that they've really been considering has been to lower rates, there isn't a great reason to do it, because the economy doesn't need any sort of a boost, right? The economy on a macroeconomic level, I'm going to explain that in just a second, is doing quite well. On top of that, inflation is just stubborn as anything right now. It's down to a reasonable number, okay? It's down to something that's in the threes. I don't want you to think that the inflation situation that we have is like what we had in 2022 when everything got so out of hand. But it is higher than the Fed's goal. The Fed's goal is 2%, and we're at 3 and something right now. So when inflation is higher than what the Fed wants, and when economic data is really good, there's not a great reason to cut rates. And so the market has been doing a lot of hand-wringing. And of course, like I talked about last week, immediately overreacted and said, oh, the Fed's going to raise rates. You know, they might. I would be incredibly surprised if they raised rates. I think they're more inclined to just sit on their hands because they can achieve a lot of the emotion that they're trying to achieve by simply not lowering rates. Remember, some of this is actual data and some of this is reaction to data. And when everyone becomes convinced that, oh, wow, the Fed isn't going to lower rates right like we thought, well, we all need to take actions related to that because they'd already priced in two or three Fed cuts. That's almost the equivalent of the Fed raising rates as the market readjusts itself to what the Fed had actually done rather than what the Fed was expected to do. Now, there's a real common saying in finance, which is past performance is no indication of future performance. And that's a disclaimer you'll read on everything. But in this particular situation, it kind of all comes true because everybody was assuming what the Fed would do when, in fact, the Fed is going to do what it does. And we don't do well when we make assumptions, especially when we don't have all the data yet. So is the Fed going to lower rates anytime soon? You know, I'd really expected a cut this summer. I'm still hoping we might get a cut this fall, but I'm not sure anything's going to happen in June. Now, I talked about macroeconomic data. That's things like the gross domestic product and all of those big measurements that show how our United States economy is going. And it's going really well. But there's also microeconomic data. And I'm not an economist, okay? So I kind of will define terms the way that makes sense to me. If macro is what's happening to, in Oklahoma speak, all y'all, microeconomics is what's happening to me. And microeconomics explains why people's perception of what's going on isn't really what's going on in the economy, because we have had groceries go up, okay? And unless prices got overly ahead of their skis, those prices aren't going to go back down. They're going to stay where they are and only start increasing at a smaller amount. So it feels like things are still bad, even though what was bad was 2 years ago, and not anything that we did in the United States' fault. My opinion. Okay, the other thing is if you're trying to buy a house, you're trying to buy a car, the higher rates are painful to you, and it causes people to say, wow, I'd wanted to buy a house, and I can't buy a house. Now, I do think it's important to remind folks that it wasn't very long ago that people had mortgages with 10%. We've just become very used to an incredibly low interest rate environment. And from the sake of borrowing money, it's really great. From the sake of lending money, so all of our more older folks who tend to be a little bit more conservative in their investment strategy, they've literally had nowhere to hide. Because when you buy bonds, when rates are going to be going up, they're not necessarily great from an interest rate risk perspective, especially bond funds more than bonds. So when you're the borrower, as in you buy the bond fund, this higher rate is better for you. When you're the lender, When you're the lender, like when you buy a bond fund, it's better. When you're the borrower, it's painful. So we're just going to watch all of this and we're going to see how it plays out. I don't think anything is terribly scary right now, but as always, I'll keep you guys in the loop.
Thank you to Sports Talk 1400 in Norman for production and studio assistance.
Welcome back to the legislative update of the Ask Peggy About Your Finances show. And this week, the Department of Labor released its final version of the retirement security rule. Now, this rule doesn't take place immediately, but it does go into effect on September 23rd, And it is the bringing back more of a fiduciary standard to financial advice that I've been talking about for the last several weeks. So it's a really exciting group of changes that should help keep consumers safer. One of the biggest things that it did is it removed three of the prongs of a five-prong test that determined whether or not someone had to hold a fiduciary standard. Because like everything else, you know, the complications happen in the details. And so everyone needed to make sure that they were defining the terms the same way. And when are you, by law, required to act as a fiduciary? So three of the prongs that if you weren't meeting these, you didn't have to deal with it, were kind of problematic. So the first was, to be a fiduciary, you have to be giving advice on a regular basis. And because the largest source of revenue for most financial professionals is a rollover. So there's money in a 401k plan or another company retirement plan. For whatever reason, the person retires or they quit working for the company and they need to roll that money over. And advisors often suggest that they roll it into an IRA that they can then manage. Well, if it's the only event that the person has, then it automatically fell outside of the fiduciary rule, which meant that you didn't have a fiduciary standard when you were taking the largest sum of money that most people have managed to accumulate and you've rolled it into an IRA or an annuity or something else, but you've rolled it out of the company plan. This new Department of Labor rule takes that requirement off the table. And so if you do something and you do it one time and the rules that are still in place exist, then you have to act as a fiduciary. The second piece that was eliminated is that both sides have to understand there is a fiduciary level of care. It's a mutual understanding. Well, the clients thought there was, but the financial professional didn't necessarily. So it's not mutual anymore. If the client thinks that the person is acting as a fiduciary and the other rules are left in place, then in fact, that financial professional has to act as the fiduciary. Their understanding that they're not does not negate the situation. And then finally, that the advice will serve as a primary basis for decision making. That's kind of a weirder rule, but Department of Labor said, no, you know, you can talk to a bunch of different people. What the financial professional is saying is what holds them to the fiduciary standard. So you can talk to half a dozen folks. You can talk to your aunts and your uncles and your best friend and your spouse and your partner. Hopefully not both. And then you can talk to the financial professional and it doesn't matter what anybody is saying and it doesn't matter how many people you're talking to. You can also talk to multiple financial professionals and the financial professional who, if you will, closes the deal still has the fiduciary liability. This is going to fix so much of what's wrong. Now, there are a couple of things that you need to know. This is an extension of an existing fiduciary rule that involves the status of money held in those company retirement plans. Company retirement plan money, by default, has a fiduciary standard associated with it, which is why a lot of financial professionals, even if you have other accounts with them, will not give you advice about your 401k plan, let's say, or your 403b plan. They'll say, I can't. That's because the minute you give advice about those qualified retirement plans, you've automatically entered fiduciary space. So what this rule is doing is that fiduciary level of care money is rolling into an IRA, technically before this rule passed, outside the protected space. Now the protected space applies to the money, so that once the money has become fiduciary driven, it stays fiduciary driven, even outside of the retirement plan. Now, other kinds of money may not. I would love to see this be a completely exhaustive everything. All the money has to be a fiduciary. But, you know, great can be the enemy of good. And I'm going to absolutely take this as a win for the fiduciary side people. The other way you can tell that is so many people are really angry about this. And to me, my opinion, it's simply a ridiculous argument. If someone's going to give you their life savings, you ought to be trying. You absolutely ought to be trying, because this business is hard enough when you try. Having people who, by law, do not have to take your best interest at heart just messes everything up. And for most advisors, again, you know, a lot of the money comes from the rollover. And so this is going to keep, if I'm making up this statistic, I'm going to say it probably solves 75% of the problem. So I'm really happy for it. Now, there is one other thing that you need to know about those rollovers, okay? Even with a fiduciary driven advisor, the minute you move money out of a qualified retirement plan or a looks just like a qualified plan, like a 403b, you lose the ability to take distributions at the age of full retirement. So let's say you retire at the age of 55 and you've got a 401k plan and you want to start taking money out of it. Well, you absolutely can, because you are fully retired. Some lines of work have younger retirement ages, but generally 55 is considered the full retirement age. This is not the same thing as Social Security. This is getting access to your 401k money without the 10% penalty. If you roll your 401k or your 403b into an IRA, now you have a 10% penalty until you are 59 and a half. So before the money rolled in, you didn't have it. Once it rolls in, you do. So there is nothing wrong with moving some of your money to an IRA when you retire. Lots of people do it. And if you have sufficient resources outside, that also works. But just be careful that if you are retiring before the age of 59 and a half, you figured out how you're going to pay for the next 4.5 years of bills.
Thank you to Sports Talk 1400 and Norman for production and studio assistance.
Welcome back to the Plan Your Prosperity segment of the Ask Peggy About Your Finances show. And after a couple of heavy segments on Fed policy and inflation and the fiduciary rule, today I'd like to talk to you about how to turn your financial dream into a financial goal. The very first thing you need to do to accomplish that is to be specific. So when we dream, we tend to say vague things like, boy, I want to be rich someday, or I want to retire young, or I really want to travel when I'm in retirement. You need to turn those kinds of statements into specific numbers or specific activities that you can price. So if you want to be rich, you need to figure out what that means to you. If you want to retire early, you need to decide how young that is. If you want to travel a lot, you need to decide where. Once you get that specific data, then you can start putting together the numbers to see whether you're on track. In order to get the numbers, the second step is to figure out how much that dream costs in today's dollars. So if you want to make 2 trips a year in retirement and each trip costs $3,000 today, you need to take that and put it into the equation. Now, You're going to be able to work either with a financial calculator or a certified financial planner practitioner who can help you. What you need to use is a discounting calculator, a cash flow calculator that can take into account the compounding of the interest of the money that you're using to save for your goal. So let's put that into English, right? You want to retire, say, at the age of 60. Well, in order to figure out how much money you need to have saved, you need to know what you're spending today. You need to inflate that forward to see what that amount is when you're 60. And then you need to figure out how much you need to have saved to have that amount every year. Two competing forces will impact how much that is: the rate of return you can earn when it's invested and the inflation rate. So when you use a cash flow calculator or you contact a certified financial planner practitioner, they can help you with that equation. Okay, this is just a math problem. So once you know how much money you need, now you can figure out how much money you need to save. So if you're wanting to take a nice trip in 3 years, then you know how much money you need to save to get there. Or if you want to buy a house in 5 years, you know how much money you need to save. Remember, as you're figuring out your rate of return, your risk tolerance will impact how much rate of return you get. And remember, too, that common financial theory, stuff you read in textbooks, will say that the shorter the time until your goal, the less risk you should take. But people can sometimes take that and go the other way and say, oh, well, I'm close to my retirement age, so I should be all in fixed income, or I shouldn't take any risk. But remember, you're going to be in retirement if you have the gift of longevity, potentially 30 years, maybe even 35 years if you want to retire at 60 and die at 95. So that's actually a long-term goal. So you need to talk to your financial professional about what that means and how much risk you should take. So it's really possible you take less risk planning for a vacation, even when you're younger, because it's in a year or two, and maybe more risk in retirement because the time horizon is longer. It's complicated. You've got a lot of things to think about. I can't tell you what to do because I don't know the specifics of your life. But when you take all of those steps, you get specific. You know how much it costs, you know how long it is until you want to do it, and then you can figure out how much to save. You're going to be able to plan your prosperity rather than just hoping that it happens.
Thank you to Sports Talk 1400 and Norman for production and studio assistance.
Welcome back to the Ask Peggy segment of the Ask Peggy About Your Finances show. And one of the most common questions I get from small business owners is, how do I start a 401k plan? And it's actually fairly easy, but you do have to contact a company that handles 401k plans. You'll have to get someone to administer the plan. And there's going to be startup costs and continuing costs associated with it. When I ask these people if they've considered another kind of small business retirement plan, they often look at me like they don't know what I'm talking about. So I want to take just a couple of minutes today and give you some alternatives on small business retirement plans. And I would recommend, because this segment's going to be a little shorter because the first two segments were longer, if you have more detailed questions about this, go to irs.gov. The most heavy document is publication 560. It's very detailed. But you can go into irs.gov and you can search for things. So you can get information about the different kinds of plans, and it'll actually compare different kinds of plans for you right on the site. Those smaller pieces of information are easier to digest. So you can, if you're funding your or your employee's retirement, you can obviously just suggest that everybody open an IRA, right? A traditional IRA or a Roth. And last year's funding level is $7,000 or $8,000 if you're age 50 by the end of 2024. So I believe that they haven't upped the contribution limit, but that's not quite enough to retire with. So if you want to get more ability to defer money and you don't want the cost of a 401k plan, you might consider a simple IRA or a SEP IRA. So simple, S-I-M-P-L-E, or a SEP. The biggest differences between the simple and the SEP is if you want to fund a SEP, you have to do all of the funding yourself as the business owner. There are no employee deferrals in a SEP. All the money comes from you. And if you're trying to fund your retirement a little bit more and you want to put in more money on your own behalf, you can't do that. Every member of a SEP has to have the same percentage of contribution amount. So if you have quite a few employees, maybe you want to do the SEP, maybe you don't. The simple, on the other hand, encourages employees to contribute to the plan. And then as the business owner, you can either match up to 3% of the employee's pay or do a 2% non-elective contribution for each employee. So if you wanted to fund the simple, you would have the ability for they put in 3%, you put in 3%. If they don't put any money in, you don't have to put any money in either. Or 2% non-elective contribution, which means that they don't have to do anything for the account to be funded. To open a simple, you have to have 100 or fewer employees, and you can't have any other retirement plans. Now, both SEPs and simples do not have startup costs associated with them. And they might not have annual costs associated with them either if you do most of this in-house. Obviously, if you outsource anything, you have to pay that person for doing it. But SEPs and simples are really inexpensive for a small business owner to set up. And the simple contribution limit is $15,500, and if you're over 50, you can put in another $3,500. Well, I'm a huge fan of people contributing, but I have lots and lots of clients who aren't putting back as much as $19,000 a year. So, you know, they hear it's a lower contribution level than the 401k, and they panic, but in truth, it's probably more than a lot of people are contributing already. The SEP has the same contribution levels as a traditional 401k, and right now it's like 25% of the first $330,000 of compensation. So if you are highly compensated and you know you're never going to have an employee, the SEP might be a good decision. The simple, in my experience, has worked a little bit better for people on a day-in, day-out business. Obviously, again, you don't take advice from somebody you heard on the radio, but this is going to give you some things to research on the IRS website. Then talk to your own financial professional, talk to your CPA. Make sure that what you're planning to do makes sense and that it will help you and your employees prosper.
You may submit personal finance questions to the Ask Peggy Facebook page and learn more at PeggyDoviak.com. And remember, prosperity is so much more than money.